Listen now to The Proof Podcast, Season 2, The Murder at the Warehouse.
How'd you find out that something had happened?
My mom called me and said, Lori, the police found a body, and they're pretty sure it's Renee.
Right away, you thought
right
Jake.
Right away.
In my head already, I thought it was Jake.
Season 2 of Proof is available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
I don't think that they arrested the right people. It's about time somebody's trying to do something.
This is a CBC podcast.
Ah, damn. These are blackberries. You hear that? Eat them, huh? Mmm. Good. We used to pick these, make blackberry pies. It's 40 years since I picked blackberries. 40 years.
We're standing at the edge of a gravel laneway, looking out over a knot of trees and vines.
The tin top right here is the house that Charles Moore and I was born in. It's a real small house, no inside bathroom. We had three rooms, a bedroom, mama's room, and the kitchen.
Up ahead, in the middle of the bush, with trees growing out of it, a rotting structure with rusty roof mostly detached and bowed over like a bedraggled weeping figure. A mildewed rocking chair, Thomas's mother Maisie's, sinks into the tilted remains of a front porch. Almost frozen in time.
When I came from Vietnam, 1966, I made it from the road to about here. And Mama must have seen me coming. She started running down the hill. Way back up there, called running down the hill. She almost fell. Arms out. I dropped my duffel bag. I took my bag off and threw it down here because I started running towards her. When we embraced each other, she was crying and I was crying. So glad to see each other. I was glad I made it back from Vietnam. And of course, she was glad that her only son was back alive. I'm proud to be here because nothing happened here but good. Colorado, New York City, Germany, Vietnam, Korea, Panama, Spain. No place I have ever been have ever been able to wipe out the good memories and the bad that I experienced over here. So this is the place that Mama used to sit on the steps, on the porch, and she'd be crying late in the afternoon. I would ask her, what's wrong? She said, well, I'm just hoping Charles Moore walked down the road. So I wouldn't even ask him where he'd been. That's all.
You are listening to Someone Knows Something from CBC Original Podcasts. In Season 3, David Ridgen revisits his 2007 documentary, Mississippi Cold Case. Teaming up with Thomas Moore to investigate the murders of his brother, Charles Moore, and Henry D., two 19-year-olds who were killed by the Ku Klux Klan in 1964. This is Episode 6. Reckoning.
Now you talk about terror. I think you talk about terror. People have been terrorized all my days.
And a suspicious package was found near federal court where the SEAL trial is going on. It was in the Edison Wampa Hotel where many of the people involved in the SEAL case are staying.
Arms rats, Klansmen, jeez.
It's June 14th, 2007, and we're watching the local news.
Tonight's lead story, the jury in James Ford SEAL's trial has now been deliberating for 90 minutes.
A hand-delivered package about a foot long was found near my van in the hotel parking garage, loaded up with papers and racial epithets. It was a bomb threat. Police said much of what was written inside targeted the U.S. government, but it didn't stop the trial. Bomb threat over, Thomas and Henry D's sisters are sitting in a room of the Edison Walthall Hotel in Jackson.
My brother Charles, you were not a wrong buddy.
While we waited for the jury to reach a verdict on the James Ford Seal trial, Thomas made use of his nervous energy to work out a statement that he wanted to read.
And you had never been forgotten, because you, Charles Moore, were my brother.
Amen. That's good. Man, that's a good remark.
Both the families of Henry D. and Charles Moore seemed confident that Seal would be found guilty. And I'd like to think the same, but anything can happen. The case hinged on the testimony of former Klansman turned church deacon Charles Marcus Edwards. It was astonishing testimony, but would the jury believe it? We wouldn't have to wait much longer to find out.
Hello?
Thomas?
Yeah.
It's Paige. There's a verdict. Come over as fast as you can.
Okay. Come on.
Come on down. I gotta get in bed one
more time. To me, a quick verdict means you guilty, buddy. Yeah, you turn it off.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine.
On June 14th, 2007, at 6:30 p.m., James Ford Seal was convicted by unanimous decision on charges of conspiracy and two counts of kidnapping where the victims were not released alive.
Remember what Johnny Cash said, that you're going to, what is it, God's going to cut you down. You're going to run, but you can't hide.
One of Seal's attorneys, a man by the name of George Lucas, wasn't happy with the jury's decision.
We're very disappointed with the verdict. We expect to appeal.
What did this case come down to you guys?
I think the credibility of Charles Edwards. Mm-hmm.
And so you guys said you will appeal?
Without doubt.
For Charles Moore now, I'm gonna let it shine.
Those appeals would eventually be exhausted, and Seal would remain in prison. He was given three concurrent life sentences to be served out at the federal penitentiary at Terre Haute, Indiana.
How was your client?
He's very disappointed as well.
James Ford Seal would serve 4 years of his three life sentences, then die in prison on August 2nd, 2011, at the age of 76.
What's your reaction right now, if you can, Ms. Collins?
Well, I thank the Lord that we got justice. And one time I thought I had to give up because I had got sick, coming so much. But I held out.
All right, Mr. Moore, just real quick,
what's
your reaction?
As I stand here today, I am satisfied that what we did, it caused the verdict to be rendered today as guilty. There's no doubt in my mind. When David and I came down here and woke up some ghosts, shook the bushes, were called troublemakers, but we never feared. So I want everybody, I want the world to see that it took a little old black guy that came from this little old raggedy place to Franklin County. Yeah. On Charles Moore's grave, there's a sign, there's a thing that Mama had put on there where he said, anywhere in glory. I can imagine right now him and Henry D. is probably walking around rejoicing.
Are you?
I am. For their sake.
You're rejoicing.
I'm rejoicing for justice in this country, but the joy has been coming a long time.
Co-lead prosecutor Paige Fitzgerald, who was instrumental to the success of the case, wouldn't speak on record during the proceedings.
Hey, Paige, maybe you can give me a quote now when it's all over.
We're just very, very, very pleased that the jury was able to reach a verdict on this case and come back and render some justice for the families in this case. It's been a long, long time coming, but the wheels of justice may have ground slowly in this case, but they finally, finally reached where they needed to be.
Good job.
Thanks, Dave.
Is this one of the last civil rights cases we're going to see in Mississippi?
They will become, obviously, fewer and fewer. It was just a remarkable set of circumstances that we were able to pursue this case. And Mississippi has made huge strides, and lots of progress.
I got a final stop to make before I get out of here. And me and Charles Moore will have a few words. My mom, I want her to be resting in peace that her son came back.
Before Thomas returned to Colorado and I returned to Canada, we drove the now familiar road from Jackson down to Meadville. Like Thomas said, our multiple returns to Franklin County had stirred up some ghosts. But can they ever be truly laid to rest? And maybe they shouldn't be. We returned to the Meadville Cemetery where Thomas's mother, father, and brother Charles are buried.
Well, I guess I'm gonna have to address my daddy first, since I never had an opportunity to know him. Dad, I think you'll be proud of me today, what I try to do. I was probably about 2.5 years old when you died. But you left 2 boys. We lived 19 years together. Mama did a good job. I think you'll be proud of that. So I hope you're proud of what I did. I'll see you on the other side. Mama, for you, I wish you were here today. I wish you were here today to witness what I had a part of doing. I want to thank you for what you did for me. The love, the care, pushing me to be somebody. And two, I will see you on the other side. Today I'm going to address you as Mr. Charles Eddie Moore. I always wanted to do something to revenge your death. I wanted to kill people. I wanted to hurt people. But Mama's word kept me focused and eventually changed my way of thinking. You know I know your nub, but not the whole world know who Charles Moore is. I thought about the pain. I thought about you crying. I thought about you hollering. I thought about how you probably wished that I was there. You know, they said that you were forgotten, a forgotten body. But I guarantee you today, you're not forgotten. I still love you. And I'm always missing. So, brother, you take care. I'll see you on the high ground. So long.
In June 2007, mere days after the SEAL verdict was handed down, U.S. Attorney Dunn Lampton was in a Jeep accident at his Muscadine grape farm, which left him partially paralyzed, the results of a severely bruised spinal cord. Dunn never fully healed from this injury. In 2009, it forced him into retirement, and on August 17, 2011, Dunn Lampton, the man that Thomas and I thought of as a sort of mirthful, swaggering Wyatt Earp, passed away. He was just 60 years old.
What do you think of all this, Ellen?
Well, it's sad. I wish we could have gotten a bit more together for a memorial, but I suppose as long as we remember them.
Back at Parker's Landing, Mississippi, in 2017, with my son. I've lived and breathed the Dean Moore case for 13 years, most of his life. He's been dragged through Mississippi many times, knows the case well, and has met many of the people involved, including Charles Marcus Edwards. But this is the first time he's visited what Thomas and I call the kill site.
Do you think they would have been happy to see the flowers you put out for them?
Oh, I'm sure. I just wish I could have met them.
Me too.
It's less creepy here now than it was at the beginning, but I still feel creeped out down here.
It's a lovely place. Lots of egrets, lovely wildlife, all sorts of beautiful natural wonders.
God, you sound like me.
Thomas and I have stayed in close touch in all the years that followed, speaking on the phone at least once a week, if not every day.
But you would never have that opportunity to do work like you and I did because it was a one-time affair.
But it was clear throughout that something still felt unfinished, perhaps unanswered. So in 2011, we decided that it was time to make one more trip down south together.
We're going to Mobile, Mississippi, my old hometown. Main Street of Mobile. It looks the same to me, other than a couple of stores that's been restored. I don't really know how much the citizens in Mobile have changed, want to change, I don't know. La 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 la. I don't know who I'm gonna get to cut this damn grass.
During our visit, we upgrade and repair the memorial that Thomas and I had set up across from the Tasty Freeze, where Dean Moore had been picked up.
I think what we need to do is repair this sign permanently. The picture has only been up there for about a year and they already faded.
Thomas and I found the only known photo of Henry D. just before the trial. It had been placed in an old yearbook by one of his Franklin County friends. Now, Moore and Dee's photos are etched into this memorial.
This is for you, Franklin County, and other parts of the world. There is still a lot of injustice going on in this country. Whether you're in Colorado, Chicago, it doesn't matter. As you drive by this, this is to remind everyone as to what happened on the 2nd of May, 1964. Yep. Good job. Mission complete.
Not much seemed to have changed physically in Meadville since 2007. I asked a few people what they thought 4 years after the Seal conviction. I met this man wearing a Hawaiian-style shirt in a Brookhaven, Mississippi parking lot.
Yeah, it's really amazing. You know, my wife and I have watched the documentary several times, and we're both amazed by the fact that we had never heard of these murders. It's inspiring to see a man such as Mr. Moore stand up and fight for his family.
And another man in Roxy.
One of the impacts of Mr. Seal going to trial was we were able to see, the country at large was able to see some of the atrocities that took place in Mississippi during the 60s.
And this young woman in Meadville.
I was extremely grateful. That was my first reaction, was thank you, Jesus, because I felt it was overdue. Mm-hmm. And it was time for all his skeletons to be revealed and him to answer for the things that he had done. And I commend you for the documentary. And also I commend the justice system for doing the right thing this time. still primarily is the same. I mean, they still have this sense of superiority over us, and I don't think that'll ever go away. I don't know if that spirit lingers here or what, but I don't think that'll ever go away. Not here in the South. Not this deep South.
And the local newspaper, the Franklin Advocate, was still going. It hadn't changed much either.
Mary Lou! Hold on a minute. That's you right there. You all for the day?
Franklin Advocate owner and editor Mary Lou Webb is the woman who wrote an editorial against reopening the case and told us that pursuing it was like beating a dead dog. We wanted to return a photo we had borrowed from her, but Thomas also wanted to ask a few questions about a continued lack of coverage in the paper of his brother's case. The discussion quickly digressed.
Well, I'm just saying your
fact. I'm
just saying your
fact. Because he was a good man and he was
I'm not attacking your husband.
All right, good
I'm just
for
saying
you.
That Franklin Advocate, the 2 weeks
Look,
prior
let
to...
Let me tell you something, what you need to do now. You need to take that chip off your shoulder and get on
I ain't got
life.
No chip.
Oh, yes, you have.
The Franklin Advocate didn't report on Dean Moore being missing, but did publish something shortly after their bodies were discovered. The article quotes a false story from Sheriff Wayne Hutto that Dean Moore had been in Louisiana visiting relatives.
I am champion for the people, not just for one guy who's still got something going. No.
Mary Lou's husband, David Webb, now deceased, is listed as being the publicity director for the Americans for the Preservation of the White Race on a July 1964 information sheet I found. The APWR helped support the Ku Klux Klan and also attempted to establish whites-only private schools in Adams and neighboring counties. The Franklin Advocate also regularly featured mentions about the APWR on their front page.
The baby's been born now. It's been in the birth canal with Thomas for 40 years, but it's been born now. Let that baby lead a good life and shut up and go on and let's all try to live together. The enemy is not here, it's overseas.
Pretty sure this is the house.
When in Mississippi, it's not such a long journey to visit an old friend in Louisiana, Henry D.'s sister, Thelma.
There's Thelma. Hey, Thelma. Nice to see you.
Oh, this David?
It's David.
Oh, man, I didn't know who you were. How you doing?
I'm doing well. It's so good to see you again.
Oh, man, Lord, how much, and glad to see you, too. I had been asking Thomas about you, and he would tell me you was all right. And every time me and him talk, we talk about you.
I keep up to date on you through Thomas, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in just talking to you about what's been going on in your life and how things have gone for you in the last years and since the trial and all that. And
well, I ain't gonna say I've been feeling the best, you know. The case was good, but sometime the problem will come back, you know. But it passed over. Just one of them things. Now and then I kind of shed a tear, then that's, you know, go on about try to forget it.
Cause I guess, I mean, we have justice, we have Seal. Mr. Seal was in jail, he died in jail, but it doesn't, obviously, it doesn't negate those horrible things and the loss of Henry.
But Mother don't know the day that he passed.
Icy Finn still doesn't know.
She don't know the day we hadn't told her.
Henry and Thelma's mother, Icyfine, has resided in a psychiatric hospital since the 1940s and will likely never be told of her son Henry's murder.
And I asked him to don't tell her because she was already sick.
Yeah.
And I told him, I said, whatever y'all do, don't tell Mama. I said, because she got enough, you know.
Yeah,
And she don't know it.
How's she doing?
She doing fine. Mama doing better than me, to tell you the truth. She just old and everything, but she gets around good and everything.
What did you think? I've always wanted to ask you this. What did you think about when Thomas and I started looking into this case?
Well, I was happy because I didn't know what to do. I'm going to tell you. All I know to do was just worry. And before y'all got this case started, my brother used to visit me with an angel. I ain't told nobody this before you. Honest person, I'm telling this. He used to come to me on an angel, and I'd be asleep, but he would be on that angel all the time, playing with me. And it would worry me a lot, you know. But I could see my brother in the water and stuff, but I didn't know who it was. I could see that. I could see it in different dreams I'd have, but I didn't know where it was. But after that trial, my brother stopped coming to visit me on that angel. So it must have quieted him down, or he must have been satisfied. Because I hadn't seen that angel since. And that's kind of odd. I often wonder, often say to myself, that must have been why he kept visiting me like that. Had to be.
Did you ever find any more pictures of Henry, by the way? Because we found that one. Did you ever find any more pictures?
I never did get no more pictures of him.
No. Have you ever given more thought to when Charles Edwards asked for forgiveness and you and Thomas went to talk to him and accepted his apology and his offer for forgiveness? Have you ever thought about Charles Edwards since the trial?
Yeah. I believe he meant it. I believe if he could do it over, he wouldn't do it no more. I don't believe he would be involved in that kind of stuff. But I believe that he meant what he said. I do.
Thomas was somewhat less certain, and I think this is at the root of why we came down here, to see Edwards again.
When he asked my forgiveness, that opened up that little tiny door for me to walk right on through and leave the chains of pain behind me. The guilt, the frustration, that when I walked through that door, it released me. Now, if he lying, then that's him and his God got to worry about that.
In 2007, Thomas had been surprised and moved by Edwards' courtroom apology, but by 2011, he was interested in having a more in-depth conversation with the former Klansman turned Baptist church deacon.
What we're going to do this morning is talk to Charles Marcus Edwards. There's some questions we want to ask him. Finishing up a conversation.
We would try to visit Edwards one more time at his home just off the Bunkley Road.
Grand Lane? Ain't that it?
Yeah, that's it. Get down there.
There were still gaps in the story of what went on that day in 1964. Gaps that could only be filled in by the one living man who was there.
My name is Mandy Matney. We all want to drink from the same cup of justice, and it starts with learning about our legal system. With tales from the newsroom and the courtroom, journalist Liz Farrell, attorney Eric Bland, and I invite you to gain knowledge, insights, and tools to hold public agencies and officials accountable. Together, our hosts create a fire lit to expose the truth wherever it leads. Search for Cup of Justice wherever you get your podcast, or visit cupofjusticepod.com.
So here we're going down to this guy's house. He done isolated himself way down here in the community. I guess he just didn't want to be around nobody. after all that shit. His old truck there, so he's at home now.
Remember to park up by the mailbox.
Fucking dog come out of that bar. C.M. Edwards.
The first time we were here, Edwards angrily ordered me off his property, crowbar in hand. Thomas had stayed in the van, filled with anxiety. How would both men react this time around, 5 years later?
There he is out there.
Okay, well, let's go, man.
Hey, fella. Mr. Edwards.
Charles Edwards was in white shorts and a t-shirt with a green camel hunting cap. Despite it being early in the morning, Edwards was already up and at work on the floor of a small aluminum fishing boat.
How you doing?
What y'all up to?
Talking to you. Come see you. How you doing?
Doing all right, you?
Can we go sit down somewhere?
We head over to a brown wooden swinging chair in the breezeway of Edwards' parking garage, and the two men take a seat. The original dog I met the first time I came is nowhere in sight, but a smaller dog that looks to be a Jack Russell Terrier jumps up onto Edwards' lap.
It's something that I always want to do.
Yeah.
I just wanted to we both. You know, I don't know how you feel about it, but when you stood up in the court and asked for forgiveness, that gave me an avenue.
Yeah, right.
But man, I hated you, dude. I'm gonna tell you flat up. I said, I'm gonna get him, you know. I didn't even know you.
I was sincere when I asked you, you and Miss Dees to give me to you, you know.
And we believe that. I seen her yesterday. We talk every week. We kind of like accepted each other, brother and sister.
Yeah.
As tragic and bad as this was, it was a God thing.
I looked at that too, and I said, if this tragedy hadn't happened, I wouldn't have been back here, and I came back here and home and helped build a church here and helped all that. It's the way life is. God's in control of our lives if we belong to Him.
For me, you know, that was the child more with my only brother, and we were raised without a dad.
I'm gonna tell you for a surety, your mother, I cried a many night wondering how she felt about knowing that her son wasn't gonna come back. And I'm gonna tell you another thing for a surety, if I knew that was gonna turn out like it did, I'd have never been part of it. I wouldn't have, but they sort of conned me into that, telling me that them people had rifles and machine guns and everything else, you know.
Did you think it was just going to be something, just a confrontation?
Yeah,
and
I didn't deny being a member of the Klan. I didn't deny that. But what they had said about that was that we'd pick D's up and question him about, and I thought that was all that was going to be touched, you know. I didn't know. But James Seale's mean song gun fella, I'm going to tell you. He's mean.
Yeah, I know.
But your brother, he was just a victim of circumstances.
Yeah, you told me that. Well, let me ask you about that. Now, I guess they had identified D because he was running in and out of Chicago with his other sister up there. And he had that hair thing.
Yeah, he had that hair thing. He was identified, you know, maybe as a black Muslim. Yeah. But him in and out of Chicago and back home, you know, he was one of the people that we're sort of looking at about the gun running deal. See if he could have any connections up there and down here, but wasn't nothing to it.
No, D was a good fella. He wasn't rowdy.
You know, I knew him. I mean, I picked him up. He rode to town with me several times from down on Kirby.
And see, I try to think that the shock and that they was on the, how bad they were beating up, I don't know, but just the fact that I know.
They got a pretty good whooping, but they were nowhere near death or nothing like that. I mean, they were good and alive when they left there with them and took them back down to the sealed place down there.
After that happened, how long did you hang around with them Crazy Joe? How long did you?
That just about ended it.
Oh, yeah.
but the FBI done got really involved in all that stuff. And I got the shock of my life when I found out that over half of the people that was in the Klan was informers. They had more informers than we did at regular meeting, the FBI did. It just went on and on, you know, the top people, they had informers and they knew more about what was going on than I did, probably. After that, it wasn't very many meetings that I ever went to. It hurt my family, hurt my wife, you know, and over.
Yeah, yeah. Did you ever think about what if that had happened to my son?
Well, sure I did. And I wondered, you know, I wondered. I had four boys, and I wondered. I said, what if some of them people might retaliate and take one of my sons, you know, and I wondered about that.
Edwards feared retaliation by the African-American community, but he goes on to talk about retaliation from a different source.
You know, God worked in mysterious ways, and my oldest son was some kind of athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And a good Christian boy, never raised his mouth. And one evening I went to work, and I borrowed a gun from my Uncle Robert down here to let my third boy have a gun to hunt with. And they came back from rabbit hunting. He was sitting there by the bathtub in the bathroom, and that boy come by there and fooled him with that gun and shot him.
Well,
killed him.
An accident. His oldest son killed by another boy using Edward's own gun in his own home.
And I felt like this. I felt like, you know, God might have got even with me.
That was after that.
It was my part in this. Finest boy I ever knew, you know. He was a Christian boy.
When did that happen?
That happened in 1973. He was 14 and a half years old.
Eventually, the conversation moves from Edward's family tragedy back to Thomas's.
James Seals is in jail because of the consequences that he did.
You know, and I got that feeling too, you know, that maybe I should have been in there too. But that wasn't part of God's plan in my life, you know, and so I didn't go.
We went seeing Seal, me and David. We went by his place in 2005, and I called him out from that road. I wasn't going down there because I feared he'd shoot me.
See? He would have.
I know, because, see, we called him out. He ran in. I said, I can't go down there because he couldn't hit me with no pistol from where I was at. But he going to get that dog on rifle.
Yeah.
I never seen those FBI 5 until 2005. Never seen them. And we knew, as we read those 5, me and David, he was in Canada, I was in Colorado Springs. We were talking 2 or 3 times a day. And we said if we could get to one of you guys and confront it, one of them, maybe turn against the other guy. That was the only way that was going to
be. That's the only way it would have happened, because I wouldn't have.
No. But he had the opportunity to do just what you did.
Oh, you reckon?
Yeah, well, we went to him first. We went to his place. We didn't come to see you until 2006, 1 year later, because I didn't have the nerve to come talk to you. I said, now, what if I go up there and you were like, nigga, get off my plate. What am I going to do? How am I going to respond to that? So me and David rode by here a couple of times. I said, no, I'm not going in there. That was in 2005.
I'll offer y'all a cup of coffee if you want.
Dave, you want a cup of coffee?
I'll have a cup of coffee, sir.
I see you got pieces and
I got all kind of fruit, man. I got more pears and peaches and stuff than I'll ever do.
I want a couple of peaches for a leaf.
Okay. I don't want anything in your coffee.
No.
I'll have a bit of milk, please.
Edwards invites me inside to make some coffee while Thomas heads outside to check out the garden. It's still early in the morning and Edwards' wife, Betty, dark-haired with glasses and a light dress, is just waking up. I'm standing in his kitchen, watching Edwards make me coffee.
What you doing?
I'm just talking to Moore and this other guy in. Coffee, you can come sit at the table if you want to. Where'd he go off to?
out there hunting him a peach, I imagine. He can get all of them he wants.
We walk back outside with coffees in hand, a pastoral scene that would have been unimaginable just 5 years before, and head for the garden in search of Thomas.
Hey, Dave.
Where'd y'all go? You get you some?
Yeah, I went and got me one of your peaches.
Dude, coffee.
Oh, thank you, bro. Let me ask you something. It's about 9:31. We've been here almost an hour. What does this talking that you and I are doing today do for you today?
Well, let you know it. We can be friends.
Yeah.
That's
for me, it's a completion. I have no more. There's nothing else that I want to do on this case. I want to be able to, and I have put it all behind, so.
Do you remember the first time I came? When Thomas was in the van, and I said, do you want, he just wants to talk to you, and you told me to get out of here?
Yeah.
What did you think at that time?
At that time? Well, I had never made no kind of confession or nothing, and I don't know. I just didn't want to be bothered with it, you know what? Yeah. I wasn't going to confess to nobody because I denied this for years when people would ask me about it. But what I really denied was taking part in really putting those boys to death. That's what I didn't deny. And people didn't ask me, did I have part in it? What they asked me was, did you kill those boys?
I still
want to
know what happened in the woods.
Well, I reckon you could say, Curtis, myself, we did the little strapping that went on. James Seal said that, and he held a gun on those guys. And that's the reason I said that they wouldn't really beat as bad as people made out like they were. But Curtis left there with James and wherever they went. But Curtis didn't go to the river with him, I don't. Because he was back that night at the Klan meeting.
So what happened at the Klan meetings?
Well, it was just like any other business venture you go to. It wasn't always all against black, too. They done some good things. They tore some white people's butts up that wouldn't work and support their family. They got them and
give them
a good whooping, you know, and they, but that's what it's all about. I told what was the lady prosecutor's name up there?
Paige Fitzgerald.
Miss Fitzgerald. I told her, I said, Miss Fitzgerald, I'm not a hypocrite. Now that's one thing you. And I said, I have nothing against any black person. I don't hold anything against them. But the only thing I said, they ought to have good jobs and a good home and everything. But the one thing, and I'm not a hypocrite now, I don't believe in intermarriage. I don't believe in that. And I tell you that, too. Yeah. But I said, I've worked with them, and I've trained with them, and I've invited them to my house, and they've eat at my table, and whatever. I said, but that's the one thing that I still have a problem with, and maybe someday I'll overcome that.
I think there's a problem with that because the reason is because, you know.
But it might not be in Colorado or wherever you're at now, but when you, and I got a niece right up the road just married to a black guy and she's got two kids. Well, they really don't fit in with the whites or the blacks, you know, as far as social stuff, not going to school.
As an observer, I stay silent, reflecting on how some things have not changed.
So what about how your community feel?
But when we went up there and I testified and I come back, and on Sunday morning when I got up to teach my Sunday school class or during church service when they had an announcement, I stood and I told them. I said, y'all know who I am and what I've done now. And I said, I'll give up my Sunday school class, and I'll give up my deaconship,
anything y'all want me to give up, but I won't give my church up. I'm going to still come to church and serve God. I said, I've done what I thought was right. And then y'all can do whatever y'all think's right about it. Well, the other deacon stood up and said, Charles, we can't do nothing but accept you and accept your apology. And we want you to keep teaching Sunday school and still be the chairman of the deacons. And I said, well, if that's what y'all want, now you be sure. I tell you what, and I look back at the day that y'all came to church up there, and I thought about it a thousand times since then. Why didn't I just ask them people to come on in church with me? That would have been the proper thing for me to done. You'd be welcome if you come here to serve God.
Yeah.
But if you come here to stir up a racket,
oh, no.
You wouldn't be welcome at all.
I think you know that that's passed on me.
But you'd be welcome to come.
What time is your church service on Sunday? The service?
The service is at 11 o'clock. Okay. If you want to come, you come.
I think you and I setting up in church is going to be a testimony for other people.
Okay.
And then Thomas and Edwards walk back into the garden to pick some more fruit and vegetables together.
Yeah, what about, you ain't got no tomatoes? I see a couple laying right there. You ain't got no tomatoes growing? I love them things. Get some salt and pepper. Come on, Dave.
These are younger.
I got five. That's good enough.
We gather Thomas's pile of peaches and tomatoes and get ready to leave.
So we'll be down there. We'll meet you at the church.
Okay.
Good seeing you, fella. I remember those words we said, y'all get off of here now, go on. You take care of yourself.
Yeah, you don't too.
All right, so we'll see you Sunday.
Okay.
Dave, I got the key.
And so, the following Sunday, we made our way to the Bunkley Baptist Church.
Morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We're proud to have Dave and Brother Thomas with us here today.
Yes, sir.
Y'all just feel at home. Like I told Dave a while ago, we're pretty informal, so.
That's good.
Thank you.
I like that.
Thomas and Edward sit together near the front of the congregation, while the pastor, dressed in Sunday best, stands at the front. I'm an atheist, but I grab a hymn book, too.
Let's turn in our hymn book to number 634. I guess on one day of the year when we sing patriotic songs, we ought to sing them probably more often.
No, tomorrow my birthday.
634.
The 4th of July is my birthday. Yeah.
My country is a
And there, in Bunkley Baptist Church, at its inception a whites-only church that James Ford Seale himself and other Klansmen from Bunkley community helped to build, Thomas Moore and Charles Marcus Edwards sang together. I have many people to thank for both leading to and making this documentary happen. To see the list, go to our website at cbc.ca/sks. But no other person need be thanked more than Thomas Moore.
You have been listening to Episode 6. Reckoning. Visit cbc.ca/sks to watch David's 2011 documentary, Reconciliation in Mississippi. And subscribe to SKS on your favorite podcast app. Someone Knows Something is hosted, written, and produced by David Ridgen. The series is also produced by Chris Oak, Steph Kampf, Amal Delich, Eunice Kim, and executive producer Arif Nurani, and mixed by Cecil Fernandez. Our theme song is Terrorized by Willie King.
Now you talk about terror. I think you talk about terror. People have been terrorized all my days. All my days. I will trust in the Lord. I will trust in the Lord. I will trust in the Lord until I die. I will trust in the Lord. I will trust in the Lord. I will trust in the Lord until I die. That's what I'm going to do. That is my theme song for the rest of my life.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.